Welcome back to Buzzardry. It is March 25th, just after 5:30 p.m. I'm Patrick McGee. We got Jonathan Brent, Jacob Fitzgerald. How are you guys doing today?
I guess a little better than if we would have done this 24 hours ago.
Yeah. Disappointed on the baseball week, but can't do anything else but put it behind you. So.
Yeah, so we will get into baseball, and I guess so. Golden Eagles go 1-3 on the week, losing to Ole Miss on Tuesday, 8-3, and then losing 2 out of 3 to Georgia Southern, a 13-1 loss and a 9-4 win and a 3-1 loss. By far toughest week of most disappointing week of the season for baseball. And I guess what was y'all's guys' initial thoughts on that, on this past weekend performance in baseball?
Yeah, I guess overarching theme, worst week of the year by far, worst week probably in a few years by far. It's kind of bizarre to think about playing a 4-game week as a Southern Miss baseball program and feeling fortunate that you went 1-3, but that's how I feel right now.
Yeah, kind of like Ostrander said, it doesn't seem like we're playing Southern Miss baseball right now, and that he pains it. So he I think he said it pains him to say that, and it certainly pains us to experience it on our end too. Coming from such high expectations, I expected a little bit of growing pains this year, and I keep saying over and over that the season's not a waste or anything at this point, but it was a tough week to watch.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the big thing you kind of look at over the weekend, we kind of knew Georgia Southern was potentially a tough matchup because they had two lefties in the rotation. They ended up only throwing one of them, but they had one of those days where they threw a righty and then they brought in the lefty, kind of like an opener type deal. But I mean, offensively, 672 OPS in league play, just 5 home runs. I mean, you just have a couple guys over that 800 mark in league play at OPS with Pratt 984, Gillespie 985, but then only guy outside of those two is Pato just at 801. So I think offensively, you just have not got the production that you needed from several guys in the lineup in the year this whole time. But I mean, you look at someone like a Wilkes that, he's a senior DH. I mean, we're thinking, all right, if he's healthy, he can be a game wrecker. Well, right now he has an 808 OPS. I mean, Pato's had a decent enough year, 909 OPS, but you haven't gotten enough production offensively, and when you don't swing well, when you can't score runs, you pretty much have to play perfectly across the board defensively and on the mound. And you're okay on the mound, I guess. We can talk about Maz later, his first bad start, but you have to play perfect defensively, and you made several crucial errors in that Sunday game. So, I mean, again, yeah, you don't hit the ball well enough, and then, you make, some, key defensive errors and, just kind of repeating, but you got to play perfectly when you can't hit, and you just didn't play perfectly outside of you got a good start from Armstead, but otherwise you just didn't play a good enough baseball. And, that was, the rubber match, and, why you went two or lost 2 out of 3 and went 1-3 on the weekend or on the week.
Yeah, are we gonna do want to go game by game or just more, I guess, overarching themes?
Big picture, yeah.
Yeah, I think that the biggest, I guess, unfortunate takeaway for me is that this season, every time we've kind of got punched in the mouth, we've come out and shown some fire. I mean, we've only had 1 2-game losing streak up until this week, where it's a Sunday against Indiana State and then Mississippi State. But you come out first inning against Mississippi State and score 4 with 2 really good 2-out hitting, and so you show some fire at least right away. And I mean, there was absolutely none of that this week at all. You play Ole Miss on Tuesday, where I felt halfway through the game, and even up 3-2, it was one of our worst play games of the year. Bad defense. We're probably shouldn't have scored any of those 3 runs. I sent a text probably in the 4th inning in the group chat that said, I feel like we should be down 5, and I feel we probably will be in a few innings, and rightfully so. And that's exactly what happened. You lose by 5. And then you turn right around on Friday and play your new worst game of the season, getting run ruled, or on Saturday, sorry, with the delay, and then play 7 terrible innings of baseball after that and before the offense comes alive. So, you're 2 innings away from an 0-4 week where there's no fight at all.
Yeah, I think the more I think about it, the more I don't want to just kind of harp on the same things we've been talking about since the beginning of the season. But I think the same things that we've been talking about for weeks were just concentrated this weekend. You know what I mean? I mean, a lot of flashes of bad that you've seen over the last couple months had, you know, all kind of came to a head this weekend. And, you know, that's not to say that I wasn't proud of the offense during the second game of the doubleheader, because there was a lot of good things that happened. But there's just so many things that are getting harder and harder to look past and be hopeful about or positive about that we're just not seeming to overcome. And as it still, to me, feels early in the season, we're not that early in the season anymore.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, another thing you look at, like, with the offense is, you know, earlier in the year when the offense was struggling, it was, you know, a situation where, you know, you can at least say, oh, well, you can make a couple changes here. You can make a couple changes, you know, at second base and third base and, you know, adjusting things at first base and center field. Well, now, you know, you've kind of made all the changes and you've had, you know, injuries at second base with Tucker out and Smith out, where, you know, you don't have any more depth, and I mean, you kind of got to roll with the guys you have out there. So you, I mean, you didn't have a ton of depth to begin with, but now with the injuries, really don't have any. And also, I mean, you kind of got to roll with these nine guys you have out there and hope they can kind of, you know, find it and, you know, find some consistency. But I mean, it's kind of looking like an offense that you've had, you know, the past 2 years where they weren't necessarily bad offenses. I mean, they were above, you know, 820 in OPS, which is, you know, by the Division I average, above average. Although, I mean, right now you're below that at 760 OPS for the year. But, I mean, it seems like the ceiling for this offense is just another kind of the past 2 years where you've been inconsistent, where you'll have, you know, a stretch like that four-game stretch, or, you know, where you had, you know, the offense had three good games at Louisiana Tech, and then they played well on a midweek against Alabama. And that was a really good four-game stretch for the offense. But now then you're also going to have stretches, you know, like you had this week where you really can't get anything going at all. In the lineup. So I think, I mean, you're just going to have to take the ebbs and flows. And I think a part of that is the inexperience with this team. I mean, you look at, you know, a lot of junior college transfers. I guess when Seth Smith was in the lineup, he, you know, a true freshman, you know, playing guys like Stockman, that's a redshirt freshman, and that, you know, Austin Odom, Jacob Keys, that are true freshmen. So you're playing some guys that don't have any experience at the Division I level. So I think that's part of it. But yeah, I mean, it just seems like you're going to have these ebbs and flows throughout the year with the lineup, where you're going to have, you know, yeah, I think, you know, probably there will be some weekends where, you know, you'll score, you know, maybe 25, 30 runs over a weekend. But then, you know, you're going to have some weekends like this where, you know, you really can't get anything much going at all. But yeah, I mean, I think that is the big issue is the offense, and I guess to a lesser extent, the defense. But yeah, did y'all have anything else on the lineup before we kind of, I guess, touched on some of the, I guess, the pitching thoughts and that kind of thing?
Yeah, the kind of the weather played a factor with the sun and the wind, but you got to know every ball is going to curve back to second base on those high pop ups. You got to make the plays that are given to you. But three errors on Saturday, three errors on Sunday, two more against Ole Miss in pretty rough situations. So that's when your offense doesn't give you a lot of wiggle room, that doesn't make it any easier on your pitching staff for sure.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, looking at the pitching stuff, I mean, you pitch it pretty well outside of, you know, I guess, you know, Friday, Mazza had, or sorry, the first game on Saturday, keep on getting that mixed up because of the postponement, but, you know, Mazza had his first, you know, bad start, I think you would say, went four innings, gave up six runs, walked three, you know, just, you know, I think Oscar was talking about, you know, the command wasn't where it needed to be, leading balls, you know, up, and they were able to hit it. And, you know, George Southern, you know, not a great offensive team, but, you know, I think, you know, obviously they played really well this week. But I think, you know, you look at Oldham pitched well. I think Armistead, those guys gave you good starts. And I think the bullpen pitched reasonably well. I mean, I think once Massa got chased, you went to a couple guys like J.W. Armistead and Drunken Miller. It, you know, don't pitch a lot, so I don't know how much you can read from that. I mean, you're going to probably need those guys at some point, but those aren't really necessarily in your core group of guys. You know, Sibley, you know, gave you a chance, even though, you know, he did give up a couple runs there late in the game, although one of those was unearned. And then I guess you kind of look Middleton still a little bit shaky. He was able to get out of that that last inning in the second game on Saturday without any damage done, but, you know, ran into a little bit of trouble. So, I mean, that's kind of the two things that I'm looking at is Mazza has to, you know, hopefully this is just a blip. You can have a fluke start where he can get back going this upcoming week against Troy. And Middleton's got to find where he was in the first, you know, several weeks of the season. You know, you look at these past you look at the Alabama game was a struggle. And, you know, he was, you know, was able to avoid, you know, catastrophe, I guess, against Georgia Southern, but they were able to put a couple guys on board. But I guess just general thoughts on pitching this week and going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say, you know, obviously that first Saturday game was an anomaly for Nico Mazza. You know, that was a head scratcher. You know, I hate to keep talking about the weekend because it makes me upset. But interesting to see how we bounce back from that. And obviously, you know, we'll talk about it here shortly, I'm sure. But interesting to see how the midweek goes this week.
Yeah, I thought Colby Allen again saved our bacon in that second game on Saturday, keeping it where it was to give the offense a chance to have that eighth and ninth inning like we did. Middleton, like you said, kind of bend, don't break. And I think the Sunday loss more than any of these three this last week stung with me the most because this is the worst kind of loss you can have with the way this team is shaping up to be. You get your best outing in the year from Armistead and Sibley goes two and only gives up one. And I mean, you don't even feel like you're in the game offensively when you go down two runs. And that when your pitching staff gives you more than enough of a chance to win and your offense can only muster up four hits and three errors behind the good performance, that's the kind of loss that's going to drive me up a wall for sure. But overall, good weeks from Armistead and Colby Allen particularly.
Yeah, and I guess the one guy out of that, you know, the core bullpen group that we did not see was McCarty English, and we'll get to that in the midweek, but he will be the midweek starter. Yeah, so getting into this upcoming week, starting Tuesday with Tulane, and, you know, Tulane, they look to be a good deal improved. I mean, not, you know, a top 50 team, but, you know, maybe a top 100 type team coming in 15-9, 2-1. In the AAC, they just took two out of three from Rice. And I guess just kind of some highlights on the schedule. They I know they lost two out of three to Lafayette. And that was a series they easily could have swept. They got walked off on Sunday. Got swept by UC Irvine at home. They swept Pepperdine, which I guess, you know, that's not as much of a series as it, you know, would have been, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. They swept Yale, two out of three against Northwestern. So they look like they're a good deal improved from where they were a year ago. You know, obviously they did make a regional last year when they got hot in the AAC tournament, but they had 40 losses. And they've almost, I think they won 19 games a year ago, and they've already won 15. So they are already pretty close to eclipsing that mark in 2024. But yeah, the guys they are scheduled to throw tomorrow is Michael Lombardi. He is a right-hander and has pretty good numbers. I mean, 3.29 ERA, 1.46 WHIP, which isn't great, but, you know, around average, maybe a touch above average. But I mean, looks to have. I can't really find any velocity or, you know, the pitch or pitches that he throws from Twitter or the D1 Fall Report or preview. But I mean, he struck out 20 in 13 and 2/3 innings, which means he's probably, you know, low 90s at least. 10 walks. Walks are a problem for him. Walk rate is almost 7 this year. Was almost 8 a year ago. So you got to take some pitches. And offensively, you know, it's pretty solid offense. I mean, 861 OPS as a team. That's, you know, a decent bit above average. Gavin Scholes, 987 OPS, 5 home runs. Jackson Lynn, who's a veteran there now, almost a 950 OPS, 6 home runs. Brady Margot, 900 OPS, 4 home runs. So, yeah, I mean, it's an above-average offense. It is with a starter that has been decent, that looks to have decent stuff. And, yeah, I mean, again, I think it's a much-improved Tulane team from a year ago, a team that, you know, has a chance to be a top 100 ball club. So, I guess thoughts on the midweek opponent.
Yeah, 97 97 in Massey, 99, I think, in RPI right now. So fringe 100 team, hope they stay up there. Tip of the cap to them for improving on a historically bad year last year. And yeah, it's a team that if you don't show up ready to play, going to get waxed, but it's at home. Hope we can feed off that. And, got a 100 point OPS advantage on us and a little better ERA, but other pitching metrics kind of side in our favor. But like you said, this pitcher sounds like he has control issues. So I hope we can take our freebies. I think that's something we've gotten away from a little bit these last few games and come in as a focused offense and try to piece it together on the pitching side, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yeah, I saw that we were doing a beer stein giveaway, so undoubtedly going to help our chances. Just like Jonathan said, we got to come ready to play. I'm excited to see McCarty English in a starting role here in this midweek, and much improved from the Tulane that we may have been familiar with beforehand. So I think we've got our work cut out for us, and as we saw last week, if we're not ready, it's going to show.
Yeah, I guess we should talk about that with McCarty England starting. So Cole Boswell obviously been the midweek starter the past several weeks, and just I think he has a good changeup, but just was never really able to throw the fastball with any kind of consistency across the plate, and just wasn't able to go really deep. I mean, I guess in Nichols he went, you know, three or four innings, but the other starters, I think he's out by the second inning. So excited to see what English can do, just because he's kind of a young guy that I think, you know, positions as a frontline starter down the line as a Friday or Saturday starter, as a sophomore and as a junior, and then I think will be, probably drafted as a junior if he continues on his trajectory. Just a guy that, you know, he's already working in the low 90s. So I think that this will be a big moment for him. And I think if he goes out there and, let's say he goes out there and throws five innings, only gives up two runs or so, I think that would be a big jolt in the arm in the midweek. And we give hopefully a legit fourth story going forward, which is, once you get to, late May and into June, that is that's pivotal. Do you have any thoughts on English getting the ball tomorrow?
Yeah, you took the thought out of my mouth of trying to groom that fourth starter when you get into May and hopefully June play. But English has shown he's got the right mentality. He's not scared to attack the zone for a true freshman, and hopefully he can locate multiple pitches for strikes in a way that Boswell hasn't so far. Not to say we're not going to need him. He very well could be first shot of the pen on Tuesday. But this gives us a new approach to maybe stringing together these midweek games. I think you're 2-3 on your midweek game so far this year. So we'd like to improve that, especially with the only one sweep this year.
3-3, I think.
If you count Air Force, 3-3. Hope you can. This can be a formula for more wins in the middle of the week and maybe get you out of the gate a little faster. Maybe keep that the attitude of the opposing lineup down. Curious to see how we piggyback it. Curious to see how long Volusia gives him in this first start, and I would expect to see Chase Adams for multiple innings, given that he didn't record an out last weekend, and maybe see if we can save Colby Allen for next weekend. But interested to see what his plan is to piece this together with a new starter tomorrow.
Yeah, I welcome any and all creative change.
Yeah, so turning to the weekend opponent, Troy, at home, and that'll be a Thursday, Friday, Saturday series with Easter. I just remember that or was reminded.
Oh,
that.
I completely forgot about that.
Reminded of that yesterday on the radio broadcast. But yeah, so Troy 16-9, 3-3 in the league. They just lost 2 out of 3 at home to South Alabama. Before that, they. So 2 out of 3 at ULM. I guess their big kind of signature weekend non-conference. They beat Indiana 2 out of 3. But it's kind of interesting. So the pitching rotation that they rolled out there this last weekend. Yeah, so the rotation that they put out there was Hartzog, Khalid Hartzog, Jarrett Gaines, and Brady Fuller, all three of those right-handers. But the guy that had been the Friday guy for him, who had kind of been a long reliever for him, but had just worked into a starting role, but he did not make a start against South Alabama, but Luke Lyon. And I guess the thing you look at him is he is another Oak Grove guy that you're going to see there in the rotation, just like he did at La Tech. And He was someone in the fall with 89 to 90, but you know, apparently he had been up to 94. JUCO ball, 0.62 ERA, 0.72 WHIP, 7 walks, 25 strikeouts. A really good number for him. Hartzog, Cleet Hartzog, he's a transfer from Florida. He's going to be low 90s, 79, 81 with the slider. Throw a curveball. And he's 421 ERA, 144 WHIP on the year, 13 walks, 28 Ks. And then the guy that threw Sunday for him, Brady Fuller, who, you know, last year he had a ton of walks, but also a ton of strikeouts, 220 ERA, 141 WHIP, 12 walks, 10 strikeouts. Fuller going to be up to 96. Yeah, last year Fuller had 31 walks, 71 Ks, and 61 innings, up to 96. So, I mean, those are probably three guys that you kind of look at as possibly being in the rotation. Garrett Gaines, 397 ERA, the other guy that started 185 WHIP, 9 walks, 17 strikeouts. And these guys, he's up to 96 in the fall. Team ERA, 493, 152 WHIP. But I guess, I think somebody that they're probably going to be possibly using going forward in a closer role is interesting because he was supposed to be one of the best pitchers in the Sun Belt, you know, maybe behind Mazza in terms of preseason, I guess, hype, you would say. It was Grayson Stewart, who had a really good year from last year, but has struggled early on this year, 864 ERA, 132 WHIP, 10 walks, 27 strikeouts, and they just moved him to the bullpen in this most recent weekend against South Alabama, and he pitched pretty well. So I think possibly that's a role you could see him in as a reliever, kind of as a stopper type role. But offensively, 934 OPS. Offensively, they started out really well, but had kind of cooled down in league play. 934 on the year OPS, but 766 in the league. So they haven't been great offensively. In league play, and I guess the thing you kind of look at him offensively is the guy that was, you know, preseason player of the year, had, you know, 20-plus home runs a year ago, Shane Lewis. He is 0 for 15 in league play. So that is kind of the big surprise. And on the year, he's only hit 167, 761 OPS. He does have 4 home runs. But they do have a couple guys above 1,000 OPS, Ethan Cavanaugh. Will Butcher, Cole Myers, Tremaine Cobb's a good shortstop for him, athletic, can, you know, make some good plays defensively. Overall, they've been good offensively, but they played a couple, you know, really weak opponents to start off the year, SIU Edwardsville, Harvard. They have not done as well in league play. So, yeah, I mean, this was a team that was, thought to be an at-large contender before the year, picked third behind USM, and they were kind of the sleeper pick of the Sun Belt, but they've just kind of been inconsistent so far, you know, winning a series against Indiana, but also, you know, losing series Northwestern State, South Alabama. But I guess what stands out to y'all about Troy heading into this weekend?
Go ahead, Fitz.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what more I can say, but I know that if we, not to get, I guess, philosophical about the season, but, I know we've taken a couple lumps along the way before this weekend or this past weekend, you know, with a couple of disappointing losses, but I don't know if we've gotten a true punch in the mouth like we did as far as losing a conference series goes yet. So I'm really interested to see what our response to that is. Ostrander saying all the right things about how, we're in a storm right now. We're not where we need to be, and we've got to do something to fix that. And I'm interested to see how that translates to the field this weekend. So I know that's nothing about Troy, but they're going to do what they do. And we've got to do what we're supposed to do. So,
yeah, Pat, you kind of teased my thoughts at the end of your breakdown of Troy. I think I kind of picture this as maybe second best conference series of the year, maybe signature home series
to compliment Coastal on the schedule. And this is a Troy team that's, for all the preseason hype they've gotten, I remember all the 11.7 guys, all three of them picked Troy preseason. I mean, it's a team with some bad losses, RPI in the 120s, 130s, and they're about to play Florida A&M tomorrow, so it'll be lower than that when they get to the Pete. Losing two out of three to Northwestern, no signature midweek win yet. That's it's not going to be the balloon that we wanted it to be, but still a good ball club. But 934 OPS is nothing to mess with, but it looks like they may be a little top heavy on the mound. Hopefully we can get to their bullpen and play better at home. But yeah, as your local Oak Grove correspondent, I'm not sure what the absence was with Luke Lyon on the mound last weekend, whether it was injury, fatigue, or disciplinary, but if he toes the rubber, I'm sure we're all going to feel the same way and know what to expect there. But yeah, it's still Troy, still good baseball program with proven history the last few years of constant regional appearances with some names on it, on the roster you recognize that have done damage in the past and some this year as well. Six contributors with a 900 plus OPS. That's a whole lot more than we have right now doing that. So yeah, should be a good test.
Yeah, and Lyon was a guy. He was a Pearl River, I believe.
Ole Miss to Pearl River to a junior college I've never heard of to Troy. But yeah, another journeyman. He was on that COVID shortened season just with Swiss Stack from Tech on that Oak Grove team that, according to my dad, would have won the state championship. But everybody would have won this championship in 2020 any sport they were playing, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, got to come ready to play. Excited to see how we respond.
Yeah, so looking at the Sun Belt results, ULL swept ODU, ULL starting to play a little bit better, you know, maybe positioning themselves to get in at large. Marshall took two out of three against Arkansas State. They lost that game on Sunday. Arkansas State won on Sunday in 14 innings. Texas State won two out of three at GMU. Georgia State won two out of three against ULM. And then I guess the big upset, App takes two out of three from Coastal. And Coastal had to come in and beat them in 12 innings in the second game on Sunday. So Coastal really struggling on the mound. And, you know, it was tough. They lost some key pieces on the mound. I know Liam Doyle, who was their true freshman ace. I mean, by the end of the year, he was their ace. And now he's pitching on Saturdays for Ole Miss and doing a pretty good job. I think he's pitched the last two Saturdays for Ole Miss and giving them quality showings. So that was a bad or a key portal loss for Coastal. And it is kind of shown. I don't think they have a ton of frontline pitching. But again, they do have a very good offense still. And then we talked about South Alabama and Troy. South Al won that two out of three at Troy. So we're talking about how South could potentially start 3-9 in the league, but now they're at 2-4. So South's back a little bit there. But yeah, looking ahead to this upcoming weekend, Marshall at App, South at ODU, JMU at Georgia State. Georgia Southern at Arkansas State, Coastal at ULM, and ULL at Texas State. And all of these, we'll see if these are all – yeah, all of these are Thursdays or Saturday, so no Sunday game. But what was y'all's thoughts on this last weekend and some of this upcoming weekend?
Yeah, tracking scores, I felt like I was looking at the Sun Belt football and basketball leagues where it's a deep league with no easy outs and anybody can be anybody. And that's not, baseball is not normally a sport where you can say that, but that appears the case this year. I mean, there's only a 3-game separation from first to last in this league. And you got 10 top 100 RPI teams, 8 in the top 100 in Massey, if I counted right. So just confirms more than anything that there's no bye weeks in this league and anybody can be anybody if they want it more.
Yeah, we're getting what we asked for, right, with the move from Conference USA to Sun Belt. So that's exciting. I was surprised to see Troy drop that series, but, that will be interesting to see down the stretch with them in South Alabama. So it's fun to be in a league that's got a lot of parity, and it's a big part of why I enjoy being in the Sun Belt.
Yeah, and I think the Sun Belt is still number 5, I believe.
Yeah.
And RPI. Yeah, that's the thing that worries me right now. It looks like it's actually number 6, just behind the Big East. Actually, the Big East is currently having a good year. I do think the Sun Belt will end up being 5 once the Big East starts playing each other. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing that worries me right now. I think we did get a question about this, so we'll wait and ask how many bids. So I'll offer my thoughts on that later when we get to the questions. But yeah, Jonathan has the questions, I think, so we'll get to those.
Yep. So we'll start with our questions from Kyle from Midtown, as we always do.
He was on a bit of an emotional roller coaster this weekend.
Yeah, it was fun being a part of Kyle's diary this weekend. He texted us at 1:30 on Saturday and said, questions, when is the appropriate time to panic? I believe that was mid-run rule. I got my short answer to that one is it's pretty close.
We're marching ever so closely to it.
Yeah, we'll see what this week does. If you lose 2 out of 3 again, that would be, I guess, the first or only the second time since in the post-COVID era that you've lost back-to-back series. Like, the only other time would be ODU and UAB, or UAB and ODU in 2022. So, yeah, you don't want to drop multiple series in a row. That's when you start kind of getting into danger a little bit. So, not completely panicking yet, but another, you know, series loss this weekend would, you know, I think have me.
I agree. I think one more, and I think the button is out of the desk, and I think 2 out of 3 this weekend, you put it on the desk and maybe even press it. Post question 2, this is after game 2. He says, are we back?
Yep, same thing. Get with me next week, and I'll have a good answer for you.
Yep, it's all about the timing, time capsule there. And then this is also Saturday night, about an hour after the second text, and he says, women's basketball question. Is Dom Davis the best women's basketball player in USM history?
Yeah, I think she has to be up there. I mean, you know, Pauline Love would be another one. She was in that late 2000s era, at least since I've been, you know, kind of following things.
Yeah, Pauline Love was the name that came to mind for me as well. And I think Dom broke the individual scoring record this weekend, or maybe it was career, but she's definitely up there, and she's one of the most exciting ones I've seen play as a Lady Eagle for sure. And we'll get to the Lady Eagles and some other questions here too. But big two wins, gritty two wins on just seven players on the team coming from behind in both games at home. It's good show to put on for our fans there last week or Wednesday and Saturday, not week again for both. all right. Now on Twitter, first question is from Cloverleaf, and Cloverleaf says, when, in quotation marks, the Lady Eagles win the WNIT with just 7 players, do you agree this will be the single greatest sports achievement in Southern Miss history ahead of the 2009 College World Series, the men's NIT in 87, and the 2000 women's College World Series in softball?
That was a mouthful. I need to get the signage ready for WNIT Chambersburg. They need to retrieve the old Nick Kempsburg sign and add a W to it in preparation.
Yeah, look, hey, shout out to Cloverleaf for speaking it into existence, right? There's a good chance for something really special to happen here. I don't know if I would say it would be the biggest accomplishment in our athletics department history or not, but it would certainly be fantastic and something that I would be just over the moon thrilled to see happen.
Okay. Yeah, I think being the last team in the field to make it all the way to Omaha in 09 is probably the greatest accomplishment. Big underdog story there, but I think with only 7 people, you're talking about a more impressive feat than in 87 where the gap between the resources and the non-resources has only gotten bigger. The 2000 women's college run, you had one of the best pitchers in America, and that's all you really need in softball. But yeah, Lady Eagles, I don't know if there's been a game time announced, but I know they play the winner of ULM and Grambling, who are about to tip off, according to my pal Ben just tweeted. I saw when I opened up the X app to find these questions. So we'll see if we get a third rematch with the Lady Warhawks in the Sweet 16, I believe it is. Correct. Sweet 16.
Hold on.
I think it is Sweet 16.
No, it's the Sensational 16 or something like that.
Oh, sorry. Was I violating a marketing brandage right?
sorry, it's the Super 16 we're looking at.
I'm so sorry, Elon. Don't come find me for this. Super 16, the Grade 8, the Fab 4, and the Championship. So I'm glad March Madness didn't coin the term championship. That's good to hear. This is from Mustard Buzzard Bleacher Creature. He says, what is the growth ceiling for the athletic department? And what does that look like for Hattiesburg/USM? And the second question is Sankey going to win?
So I don't know if he's speaking in terms of revenue, the growth cap, kind of an abstract question, if, you know, without the defining parameters. But I think it has a lot less to do with what we do as an athletic department and a lot more to do with the environment of college athletics. And I really don't know how to elaborate more than that.
I agree with the add-in that this is a transformative chapter in college athletics. And if there's ever a time to, if you've ever debated being all in or contributing more, contributing to different facets of whether it be the university or athletic department, that this is the time. And as he alludes to in his second part, with some comments Greg Sankey made this week, or I guess they got leaked last week, that there's the patience is getting thinner for the powers that be.
Yeah, I guess in terms of, I mean, I guess you kind of look at like the ceiling by sport. I mean, you kind of look at, I guess just realistically, you look at like the ceiling for football would be, you know, okay, you make it to the playoff one year, but, you know, you'd probably be matched up with the, you know, with the way it's going to be set up. And I don't even know what the 14-team playoff will look like now, but, you know, it'll probably be like Georgia or Ohio State. So realistically, maybe you get like a New Year's Six bid, but then you would, you know, get paired up with like a really good team and then you probably get beat pretty badly. So that's maybe the ceiling for football. I think, you know, basketball, I think, you know, I think in basketball, you look if everything aligns right, you know, one day, maybe if you have a great team, you get a 12 or 13 seed, you can make it to the Sweet 16. And we saw JMU came a game away. We've seen schools that are either, you know, similar size or smaller than USM that have made it to a, you know, a Sweet 16 Elite Eight with teams like Oral Roberts and St. Peter's and Princeton and teams like that. And I think, you know, baseball, I think you look at the ceiling is, you know, we've seen it with Omaha. And, you know, hopefully when, you know, one of these years you can get to Omaha and, you know, make a little bit of noise. But, yeah, I guess that's kind of with the ceiling or is the growth or the ceiling for each sport. And then I guess as it relates to Hattiesburg, I mean, I guess, I don't know, man. The more the team, if you grow the teams do well, that grows enrollment, that grows the city. I mean, I've always said that, if USM, if they the Metro Conference had come to fruition, or the Metro Conference of football, they came to fruition, I've always said that Hattiesburg would have double the amount of people it has now, and that my home would be probably double the value that it's worth now, just based on what you know, big time college athletics can bring to a community. I don't know how that impacts Hattiesburg. I mean, I guess if you know. Go on a run, kind of like JMU's having right now, where they're, you know, dominating a football, winning a basketball. That would certainly help things. And keep what you're doing in baseball, obviously, just, you know, making regionals and super regionals.
Yeah, I heard an interesting tidbit when I was watching games, March Madness games this weekend, that I believe it was Utah State, that they didn't have a single returner on this roster, and that's a team that not only didn't squeak in, they were either 8 or 9 seed, and you're 1 seed off from not having to run into a buzzsaw in Purdue, and had a really great year. I think their coach took a new job today, but it's proof that a full-on portal transformation can work if you get the right pieces, the right attitude, and the guys gel really fast. So I think that's what you're looking like is the new model for the ceiling in basketball, and that Utah State proved that to be true. And we've shown this year, JMU, that, and as far, and also a bunch of teams in conference USA, when we were still in it with a lot of these schools, that it's pretty common for us to win that first game and maybe squeak a Sweet 16 in here every year, 2 or 3, as far as basketball goes. Next questions are from Jace. It's a 3-parter. First question is, what changes in the lineup do we need to make in order to get the hitting more consistent? I think we already touched on this a little bit, and that's what makes it so frustrating, is that I feel like early in the year we were clamoring on maybe switch at third, switch at first, Butler in left field, switch to DH. And I think we've done all of that, and we've got a what we think is the highest potential lineup as far as the nine humans in it. And maybe it's a switch now, especially you've got your injuries out the middle to Smith and Nolan Tucker. So I don't know that it's a change in human. I don't know when we move Monaster down, you tweaked with it a little bit, but I don't think you're going to see a lot of change in the order either. I think it's got to be a change in approach, a change in focus, a change in attitude, execution, whatever it is. I think that it's not necessarily a turnover in humans in the lineup at this point in the season. I don't know if y'all agree or disagree.
No, yeah. I mean, I think, again, like we talked about earlier, you kind of ran out of changes to make. And we talked about Wilkes early in the podcast, but I mean, I guess I kind of totally forgot about Nick Monastir. I mean, he's below 800 OPS, and he was somebody that was, you know, I thought had a chance to be a 1,000 OPS guy. So you got to get the guys that have done it before going. You got to have those guys performing up to where they performed in the past or, you know, playing at their ceiling. And, I mean, that's kind of how you get it going. And, you know, hopefully you get a little healthier. You get Seth Smith or Nolan Tucker back. But yeah, I mean, there's not really a whole lot of chance to be made just because he's kind of eroded what depth you had with these injuries.
Yeah, you all said what I was going to say. So,
second question from Jace. He says, why can't we get an outfield deck in left center field like Georgia Southern? We have enough room, and it would increase seating capacity.
The only thing I would say is I know that there are some you know, renovations coming down the pipe, and who knows what's in it. Maybe there is a left field deck. I would say as of right now, there's not a whole lot of real estate as far as what's behind the fence available in left field, considering the large billboard that's been there for years, the new Coca-Cola sign, and the big scoreboard now. So,
yeah, as a kid who spent the first 12 years of my life behind that left field fence, there's not a whole lot of room to throw a tennis ball or a baseball or anything like that. I've had to jump in that ditch between the field and the trace a lot of times.
It's very rural back there, I'll say that. That's for sure.
Yeah, I know people who watch the Super Regional from a tree. They built their own little tree stand in the left field woods. So I think that's all you need to know about the ruralness of left field. Pat, you have anything to add there?
No, I think I'll say it.
And then three, his last question is, way too early regional projections. Ooh, throwing the R word out now, aren't we?
I'll say they get it high enough to. I still think they'll kind of find it and kind of dominate some of these Sun Belt series and get it some sweeps in there, and they'll find a way to be a 2 seed in Baton Rouge.
Fitz,
if LSU even hosts, who's not playing well at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I at this point, you know, with what I see, I'm seeing that, you know, a 2 seed or. Around there at a regional power like LSU. So, but you never know. We're the power's in our hands. So,
yeah, I not to be the pessimist here, but I think I just wanted to make the point of if you continue on this path of the 2 out of 3s every weekend, the inconsistent midweek play, you continue this progression. You've got, you say, 20-10 in the Sun Belt, 500 and midweek play combined with all this conference play starting, and your ACC, SEC, Big 12s of the world are going to get helium, RPI helium, and we're going to get whatever the opposite of helium is just from the consistency that the powers that be play each other. I mean, you're looking at a team that is firmly on the bubble and is nowhere near guaranteed a slot in this field. And yeah, we're starting on a similar path that we had the last 2 years and 3 years even, I'd say. And I think all three of those teams hit their stride at this point in the year where we rattle off that 13 or 14 in a row in 21. We hit that good stretch in 22 and 23. And this is that turning point in the year where you have to not just stay at the path you are, but increase your level of play and increase your wins if you want to feel comfortable to be in the field. Because I don't think we're anywhere near entitled to a regional spot right now at an RPI of 52 at 15-9.
Yeah, and it's going to come down to, I mean, I think 20-10 usually gets you in the Sun Belt, but I mean, I think a big problem is your higher RPI games are at home. I mean, I guess, you know, we thought Troy and Coastal were going to be two of those, and you know, you look at Troy not necessarily having the start that everybody thought they were going to have. But yeah, I mean, you need to avoid some of these RPI landmine losses, like your, you know, ULM at home is going to be one of those. Arkansas State and Georgia State, maybe to a little bit lesser extent. Nichols at home, maybe a little bit in there in the midweek. But I do think 2010 gets you in. I think once you start getting into that 19, especially 18 wins, and then somebody that gets a little bit easier. But I think 2010 is a good place to start in terms of feeling pretty good about how much changes.
Next question is from Colin. He says, if the Sun Belt beats each other up in conference play, will the conference still maintain enough respect to receive a deserving number of bids, or will that hurt the number of bids received?
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of look at the early Sun Belt results. I mean, I don't know if there is a, in the years past, last year you really had two, I would say, great teams with Coastal and USM finishing there in the top two. And then you had a little bit of a drop off for ULM. Right now, I don't see really any dominant or great teams in the Sun Belt as of now. I mean, that could change. So, and that's what kind of how you get your at large bids. I mean, you'd rather have three or four great teams instead of maybe seven or eight decent to good teams, just based on how these selections are often made. And right now, you don't have any great teams. You probably don't have a ton of bad teams. You just kind of have a bunch of decent teams right now. And you need a couple teams to emerge and kind of become great teams if you want more at-large. So we'll see if anybody can kind of break away. I mean, right now, ULL is kind of maybe playing the best out of anybody in the league, but they have they lost 2-3 to Rice at home, so that's going to hurt them. And they weren't able to win a game at Texas Grinders Classic. So somebody's got to – a team or two is going to have to emerge here, and if that doesn't happen, then it could, somebody could end up with fewer teams than was expected before the year.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. While it's great to have 10 RPI teams in the Sun Belt right now, you've only got two in the top 50, and at the end of the day, the top 50, top 45 teams are the only ones that are going to get into the tournament. So you really need, like you said, a few of those teams to separate themselves. And despite the fact that you may have 10, which is maybe the deepest we've ever been RPI-wise, that's not going to garner any extra national respect. You're still going to stay either fourth, fifth, or sixth. You're not going to jump to the third best league in the country, and that's not going to give you any extra bids or respect or bullet points come Selection Sunday in June. So even though we're deep, we haven't had any top-end people rise yet except Coastal. Next question is a three-parter from the ghost of Ellis Johnson, and they're all football related. He says, because I'm a football sicko and baseball does not exist, number one, do y'all think we see any surprise roster moves before the fall, i.e. cuts or transfers?
No, I mean, I don't have anything specific in mind. I mean, there always, especially these days, seems to be some head scratcher thrown in there at some point, but who knows?
Yeah, I would say something at quarterback, some kind of transfer at quarterback, just based on the way the mobility of the quarterback position nowadays in the transfer portal, where, a guy doesn't look like he's going to play, then he'll transfer out. So, maybe one of the quarterbacks. I mean, I would guess the most likely of those would be if Ethan Crawford doesn't win the job, he could possibly transfer out. That's not based on any inside sourcing or anything. That's just really just a guess, and kind of looking at how other quarterback situations across the country is played out.
Yeah, I was going to say that too. I mean, you got four quarterbacks in that quarterback room, and three who have D1 experience, and one in John White, who's Mississippi's all-time leading passer, that you feel pretty deep as far as quarterback room goes for at the Group of Five level. And at some point, some people are going to separate themselves in that battle. And in this day and age of college athletics, not just a quarterback, but at the whole roster, it'd be rare to retain 100% of any roster, whether that be spring or fall, turnover-wise. And as far as if that occurs, I think that the first two position groups you'd see us maybe try to pluck a portal person out of would be receiver and linebacker, I think, is the two groups we may extend to Olive Branch to, and that we may have some depth concerns there. Second question from the ghost of Ellis Johnson says, how do y'all feel about the report so far from spring camp? This is where not having Ben's probably going to hurt us, because neither Fitz nor I are at every practice like Ben was. But yeah, it looks like the defense has adopted to this new scheme real well. I guess I'm excited about that. More zone focus, more eyes on the quarterback. like I said, deep quarterback room. It sounds like all four quarterbacks have done some nice things, and I don't think that there's a front runner in the clubhouse or anything. But we just sound, I guess, deeper than years past, and I hope that that's the case.
Yeah, I think the big thing for me is MJ Daniels moving to safety, evidently. I mean, he was last year, toward the end of last year, really was a pretty good CB1. He's, you know, not only did you call him a shutdown corner, but he was definitely above average and played really well down the stretch. And so he's moving to safety, evidently. So we'll kind of just see how that plays out in the secondary and, you know, kind of how they shuffle that around. And, yeah, I mean, you know, new scheme offensively, new scheme defensively. That was the big thing that stood up to me is that, you know, Daniels, who was, you know, I think arguably the best defensive player coming back, moving to Wisconsin for them.
And then I guess last question, because the other of these are just conglomerate insults of our offense, and Greg Sankey says, each of your bowl predictions for the spring depth chart.
Yeah, I'm completely shooting from the hip in anything that I say, but you got to think, and I hadn't paid attention to a lot of the practice reports either. Shame on me, but I got to think that Rodemaker starts at quarterback, right? I don't have any kind of inside information on that, but it just seems like what I assume would happen. But it's really the only one that I'm comfortable even mentioning because of how unfamiliar I am with the status of the practices in the spring. So,
yeah, you know, I'll say, Davis Dalton is top two receiver on the depth chart. Maybe there's a bold prediction for you.
I'll say Larry Simmons is one of your top two receivers, and he recovers well. And I'll say that I don't know if this is a name, but just depth chart wise, we see a whole lot more 2 and 3 tight end sets than we're accustomed to that use tight ends as receivers, not just blockers. It sounds like that Coach Long's doing that a lot more in practice with these kind of zone and leverage schemes with these more compact sets. And I'll say that our secondary corner specifically goes from our least deep spot last year to our most deep spot this year when the season rolls around, all our ACLs get healed. But just a couple scrimmages and a few practices, enough of data based off of that. So a whole lot can change and a whole lot of transfers can occur too in today's day and age. But yeah, I think that's it as far as questions go.
Okay, well, I think that will do it unless you guys have anything else. Okay, so
nope.
Yeah, we will be back next, I guess next Monday or next sometime next week. And we thank you guys for listening.